Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. Today's guest is best-selling author John Grisham, whose new novel is A Time for Mercy. He's joined in conversation by journalist Holly Furfer. And now join Holly Furfer as she introduces John Grisham.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. Look it, I am sitting with none other than John Grisham. Hello, I'm Holly Furfer with CNN, and this is going to be a fabulous afternoon. I want to welcome everybody on behalf of the Marcus JCC here in Atlanta and the National JCC Literary Consortium. This is going to be such a great conversation because, John, we're so thrilled that Jake is back. A Time for Mercy is the sequel to Sycamore Row and A Time to Kill. Both of those. Okay, so I don't really need to introduce who this is, but let me just give some folks a little facts, John, about you. Because you have 34 novels, is that right? 34?
I think so, yeah. That sounds about right.
You have nonfiction, you have a collection of stories, 7 novels for young readers, more than 350 million books in print, 45 languages. I mean, that's amazing. And you have time to be so charitable. I want to tell people that you devote a lot of time to rebuild the Coast Fund for the Gulf Coast Relief in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. So I think that's really important. I want to talk a little bit about that later too. But how are you doing during this weird time of COVID?
Surviving. I'm like everybody else. I'm tired of it. We're trying to, you know, look at the winter and wonder how bad things are going to be the next few months before we get lucky and get a vaccine, maybe. But you know, it's been a tough year for a lot of folks. We are luckier than most. We have not had the virus, and so we're healthy and in quarantine, and our family's healthy. So we consider ourselves to be very lucky. You know, there's a lot of folks who are living in fear, they're sick, their loved ones are sick, or folks who are out of work or worried about their mortgages. And there's a lot of fear and sadness right now. And so we just feel very fortunate.
Well, and we appreciate the fact that you have a time for mercy for us because, you know, in those small moments, this has really, truly been a mental health moment to pick up a book like yours, disappear from all the troubles, whether it's COVID, the election, the weather, whatever it is. And we appreciate it. So tell everybody about A Time for Mercy.
A Time for Mercy is a story that takes place 5 years after the trial of Carl Lee Hailey in A Time to Kill. That was 1985. This is 1990. Jake, our hero, Jake Brigantz, is now 37 years old. And when we see him, he's still in the same office, the same small town, struggling, scrambling, trying to get ahead. He thought after the Carl Lee Hailey trial that he would attract a lot of clients and a lot of money. That has not happened. He's still struggling in a small town, very similar to the one I practiced law in for a long time. And Jake is sort of forced to come to the defense of a 16-year-old kid who pulls the trigger and kills a man. And the child was abused and traumatized. And it's the man he killed was his mother's boyfriend. And the guy was a nice cop, but a bad drunk. And he was a deputy sheriff. So you have a dead cop in a small town, and no lawyer wants that case. No, I know from experience that lawyers in these small towns where there's no public defender system really kind of duck these types of cases because they're very unpopular, and Jake wants no part of it. The judge, though, Judge Noose from A Time to Kill, leans on him heavily and sort of makes him take the case. And once Jake is stuck with it, he comes to the defense of the kid and his family, and we're headed for a big courtroom brawl. And that's what the story's all about. Jake back in the courtroom.
I love that. I love it. Why did you choose to only do 5 years? I mean, because you had A Time to Kill, Sycamore Row, which was only a few years later. So you're kind of, you know, a lot of people might say, well, why, you know, think, oh, well, it's going to be about him now, but it's not. So why did you keep it back then?
Well, when I started together, Jake is very autobiographical. He and I started off together at the same age. In 1984, when I was writing the book. But over the years, I've aged quicker than Jake, and he's only 37 now. I'm quite a bit older. I put the book in 1990 for several reasons. It's pre-internet, pre-digital, no such thing as email or cell phones. The biggest reason, though, in 1990, throughout the death belt, as we call it, the active death penalty states, it was not unusual to see a teenager put on trial for capital murder with the death penalty in play. The Supreme Court has since stopped that about 10 years ago, saying that, you know, you can't put teenagers on trial for their lives. But in 1990, it was not uncommon. And I never had a case like that. But I wanted to pose the issue, the question of how are you supposed to treat teenage killers? You know, they're different. They're younger. They do stupid things and all these reasons that we know about kids who kill. But the victim is just as dead, regardless of who pulled the trigger or how the age of the killer. So I wanted to pose that question for the reader and hopefully answer it. But I couldn't answer it because I don't know the answer. I don't know what is the best way to handle teenagers who do pull the trigger. That's what the story is all about. So 1990 was crucial because the law has been changed since then.
How have your opinions of that changed? Because, you know, coming from, like you said, the death belt, the Bible belt, deep south, and how we've changed as a society, did you sort of have to go through a transformation of the way you think about it, going from a young lawyer now to an experienced, you know, novelist?
Yeah. Big change. A big transformation happened in 1994. After I published several books and I think a couple of the movies were out, and I was on death row in Mississippi researching a book called The Chamber that I was trying to finish. And I'd been to death row a few times, and I had met some of the inmates, the guards. I had met the executioner, the man who bruised up the chemicals. Back then it was the old, it wasn't lethal injection. It was the gas chamber. And I sat in the gas chamber, and I was doing my research, and I had a conversation with the chaplain, who was a retired Baptist preacher. And we talked about life and death and God and Jesus and what were we doing? Was it right for the state to kill people? And I changed my views on the death penalty because I've been raised in a typical Southern Baptist environment where, you know, the death penalty, eye for an eye and all that kind of stuff. And I thought the death penalty was a good thing. It's not. So I changed my views on that. Especially my views on teenage killers is still, I'm struggling. I mean, I'm really having a hard time. I think it's great that we don't put them on trial for capital murder anymore. I wish we put nobody on trial for capital murder and didn't have the death penalty. But I'm not sure what you do with kids who there's some kids do some horrendous crimes and they do some bad things and they have to be punished. So I'm still struggling with that.
What was it about that conversation with that chaplain or sitting in that room that really made you change your mind? Because that seems like it's a quite pivotal moment for you.
He asked me, he said, John, are you a Christian? And I said, I am. And he said, do you think Jesus would condone what we do here, killing people?
Wow.
And I couldn't say yes. I couldn't say yes. And he said, can you and I and everybody else agree that killing is wrong? And I said, sure. He said, why then is the state allowed to kill? Mm. And I couldn't answer that question either. And that's when I changed.
We know you've been involved with the Innocence Project. How did you get involved with that? Did this sort of lead you to something like this, or was it completely separate? And has it changed the way you write your legal dramas?
Completely separate incident because I had never thought about nonfiction. I was having too much fun with the legal thrillers and novels, and they were doing quite well. But in 2005, I read the obituary of a man who had just died, obviously. And he and I were the same age, same race, same religion, same socioeconomic background, a lot of same small town background, almost the same part of the country. He was from Southeast Oklahoma. I was born in Northern Arkansas, and he had just he had been convicted of a murder he had nothing to do with. All white. He's white. The victim's white. All white jury. Everybody was white. And the small town where he was a sports hero turned on him and convicted him and sent him to death row in Oklahoma. And he came within 5 days of being executed. Great story. Just a great story. And I said, I've got to write the story. So I got involved with wrongful convictions through that book. And once I realized that there are thousands of innocent people in prison, I became, you know, more of an advocate or you know, an activist or whatever you want to call it. I've written about wrongful convictions in several of my books and will continue to do so.
We're, you know, I know obviously you were a lawyer for 10 years and you know, part of the legal profession, but where do you come up with sort of the ideas? Is it something, like you said, you read this, does it give you ideas for your fiction books, or is it through other lawyers? Is it, you know, how do you, because each one is so different. I mean, just the one you read about which is probably one of my favorite of your novels, about the law school graduates, or not even quite graduates, and how they sort of game the system a little bit. I mean, just that idea was brilliant.
Well, that idea was stolen from a magazine article that I saw one day. I was surfing the internet. I'm not sure what I was looking for. And it was an article in the Atlantic magazine, and it was called The Great Law School Scam. And so I read this incredible story about these for-profit law schools I'd never heard of. There were a handful of them around back then. I think most of them have gone under. And they kind of lure in students who have no business in law school, let them in to school, encourage them to go borrow huge sums of money in student debt and load up on debt, promise them jobs. When they finish law school, there are no jobs and they can't pass a bar exam. And that's what the article was about. And I thought, this is too good to pass up. I've got to explore this. And I did a bunch of research, and the more I dug, the deeper it got, and it turned into a really fun book. No, but you were correct. I read newspaper articles, magazine articles, stuff online, books, always trolling for a story, always you're trying to find maybe an issue like capital punishment or wrongful convictions or mass incarceration or sentencing disparities or for-profit law schools, or environmental destruction in Gray Mountain, or insurance fraud like in The Rainmaker, or homelessness in The Street Lawyer. You know, some issue that I care about, I want to learn more about. I learn something with every book. It's experience for me to pick a topic, pick an issue, and learn as I'm researching. So, I'm curious. I guess I'm curious. I'm always looking for stories. And, you know, you take that curiosity with probably a hyperactive imagination, and, you know, there are a lot of stories.
And you're constantly writing stories. I mean, it seems like every year we're like, is this it? Is it coming out? When's it coming out? But how do you do not only cultivating the idea, but all the research? Because unlike some novels where, you know, fiction, where you can sort of, you know, fudge the truth a little bit, yours is based in law, and yours is, you know, people would go, oh, that's not right. Oh, that's not right. But you're spot on every time. So how do you get it all done within the time and get out the next one and get out the next one? I feel like your brain's so full.
Well, I do make mistakes. And when I get caught with a mistake, I fess up. I say, sure, I blew it. I cut a corner there. I got lazy. The research does take some time. You know, it's like preparing a lawsuit. I learned, as a young lawyer, that the best lawyers in court are known for their meticulous pretrial preparation. You cannot beat the prep. There's no substitute for it to know everything about the case. I don't go that far. I don't work quite that hard, but I plan the books and I outline the books and I work on the stories until I'm sure they're gonna work with a very compelling hook to get the reader in, a way to sustain the tension for, you know, 300 pages. Leading up to an ending that I hope is unpredictable. I hope it's satisfying, but unpredictable. I don't want the reader to know halfway through how it's going to end. So I really work on the ending. And once I get those three pieces together and think about the story for a long time, I'll sit down and work on an outline. Just work on chapter. In chapter one, write a paragraph. What happens? Chapter two, another paragraph. Chapter three. That makes you see the whole story, and it makes you realize maybe you don't need that subplot. Maybe you don't need that character. Maybe you do. But when there's a rule I tell aspiring writers and students, do not write the first scene until you know the last scene.
Really?
Yeah, that takes some work. But if you know the last scene, it's very hard to get lost. And writers are notorious for having brilliant attitude, brilliant ideas about this story, this conflict. And they charge you off and write for a year and they have 50,000 words and they stop because they can't get out of it. And I'm too lazy to waste that much time.
But do you though find yourself where things kind of, as you're getting into the story, maybe things change a little bit, or do you have a pretty firm structure?
I have a firm structure. I have learned you cannot outline everything. You cannot predict everything, and you don't want to, because the surprises are too much fun. When you're in a story and you've got it, you know, you've got the plot going, you've got the pacing going, and then suddenly you see a way to create something or include something that you didn't even see coming, a character, a scene, a subplot, whatever. The surprises are just too much fun.
I have to tell you that in Green Mountain and the name's escaping, I love that you have some female lawyers, some young female lawyers as characters. When you create a character like Jake or Mitch or any of them, these new, how do you sort of, do you do the character first? Do you know who this person is? Kind of get them fully established and then talk about their journey, or do they develop as the book goes? Because each one of them are so different, but they inherently have the same, you know, morals, values, ethics, and characteristics.
Yeah, I struggle with characters because I'm so plot driven. I don't want to slow down very much and talk about and flesh out the character. You have to do some of it. I don't want to talk about all of his or her relationships and, you know, all the stuff, the family relationships or family conflicts. Some is okay, I want the pages to turn. I want the book to move. These are page turners. This is suspense, and good suspense. You can't get too slow. You can't throw in paragraphs after paragraph of description of, place or time or food or, you know, clothing or what they're wearing or, you know, whatever. You got to keep it going pretty fast. The female aspect, my wife is my first reader. She always has been. And with the very first book, she said, you know, your female characters are really weak. And I said, well, okay. She said, you've got to think like a woman. And I said, that's impossible. How am I supposed to think like a woman? And so we've had this running feud now for 35 years about the female characters. I try to change them and make them older, younger, whatever. One reason is I think 2/3 of all books are purchased by women, even my books, right. women by fiction. And, so yeah, kids, one time I got a letter from a black guy and he said, you know, I love your books. He said, it would be so cool if you could have a black hero or heroine as the main character. And there was nothing, you know, there was nothing racial about it. He just said, it'd be so cool if you could do that with one of your suspense novels, have the lead guy, the protagonist, as a black person. And I thought, well, I've included plenty of black people in other books, especially Time to Kill, the Sullen books. Right. And I said, okay, that's a challenge. I'm going to do that. So I wrote a book called The Racketeer that starts off with a promising young black lawyer who's in prison. And he gets out and gets into all kinds of hijinks. But, you know, that just dawned on me. And nobody ever said a word about the fact that my protagonist was black. Because, again, it wasn't a racially conflicted book. But I'm always looking for some other, you know, some different way to approach the hero or the heroine.
And it seems to me, too, your books all have a different approach to them. This one opens up with a pretty dramatic scene. So do you kind of think, all right, I need in this one to grab everybody right away, just boom, right in, because I was going through it going, oh, wow.
Yeah, I really, if I have not grabbed the reader in the first chapter, I've made a mistake. And I heard a writer one time talk about that very aspect of writing suspense. He said, if you want to know if something's going to work, go watch a movie with a 10-year-old kid. If nothing happens in the first 10 minutes, that movie's probably in trouble. the kid's bored, the reader's bored. So yeah, you got to get the reader involved real fast, and you got to hook them for the long haul too. You've got to keep the tension going for, 300 or 400 pages.
You're listening to best-selling author John Grisham, whose new novel is A Time for Mercy. He's joined in conversation by journalist Holly Furfer on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
How have you seen your work change when you go back and look at some of your earliest novels and all in between? How have you changed as a writer and author, through your books?
Well, I don't know if there's been a change. There has been a deliberate effort for 30 years to make the next book the best one. I mean, I hope that after doing it so many times that I don't just crank them out. I don't just go through the formula. I want to make them all new and fresh and different. But also, I want to be a better writer. I try to read writers who are better than I am, and there are a lot of them. But I get inspired by really good writing. And I'll read some great writing, and I'll still, at this stage in my life, I'll say, I really wish I could be that good. And maybe if I slowed down some, I could do it. I don't know. But I have a hard time working slow. So I'm always looking for, good writing. So I want mine to improve. So each time out, I tell myself, start off slow and let's make this, read beautifully and captivate the reader. So it's still an ongoing challenge.
Who are some of your favorite writers?
There are some writers that a handful that I'm going to go buy their book the day it comes out. Ian McEwan, British guy, is really one of my favorites. John le Carré, the old British espionage writer, has always been a favorite of mine. James Lee Burke, in our country, has always been one of my favorites. Scott Turow, another lawyer writer who's very, very good. I read a lot of different people. I read a lot of nonfiction that I probably couldn't recommend because it's about the issues I write about, criminal justice reform. And I read a lot of stuff like that when I'm writing fiction because I kind of need to know it, and it may inspire another novel.
Every time a book comes out, boom, hits number one, right? We said Amazon book of, October 2020. Yeah. But do you ever have a moment when you release a book and then you go, but do you always still have that same sense of, oh gosh, I hope it does well? Or do you know, hey, my readers know me. They know it's going to be, something that's relatable. They know what they're getting. Or do you kind of go, oh?
I have never taken it for granted, and I hope I never do. I still get the butterflies on publication day. Used to until this year. Publication date was a big deal because we would go to New York for 48 hours of just fun, but to launch the book and interviews, I've done CBS Early Morning Show with Gail King for 10 years in a row, and Anthony Mason, I know all those people, and it's fun to see them again. But when the book on that Tuesday morning when the book comes out, I'm going to be on CBS. We're looking at numbers. I have a team at Doubleday, and they are determined. We've been together for 25 years, but they are determined every year to have the book debut at number one. It's just a matter of pride for them to do that, and I'm very proud of it. But I don't think about it as much as they do. But again, I don't take it for granted. I appreciate the readers and the people who have enjoyed the books for many years.
So talk about Jake a little bit. So Time for Mercy, we saw him in A Time to Kill. And I think a lot of people, we read the book and then we saw the movie. And now when I read Jake, Sycamore Row then, and this one, I see Matthew McConaughey. But you're very instrumental in it being Matthew McConaughey. I think he owes you his career.
We did a a Zoom about a month ago. He has a new book. His first book is out. And so we did a 1 hour Zoom. I'm sure it's posted everywhere, and had a great time talking about what happened 25 years ago with Time to Kill. And it's a really fun story. I mean, Joel Schumacher, who directed The Client, finally talked me into selling the film rights to A Time to Kill so Joel could do the movie. And we had this cast that included Samuel Jackson and Sandra Bullock and Ashley Judd and Kiefer Sutherland and Donald Sutherland, Oliver Platt, all these great actors. And we had a really good script. It was a big budget movie. The money was committed. They were actually on the set in way down in Canton, Mississippi, ready to film at the courthouse. And there was no Jake. We had no star. And they had approached several leading actors of 25 years. Kevin Costner was one. And a lot, they all said no for various reasons. Most of them are committed, you know, elsewhere. And we got down to Jake, and I had retained, and I don't get involved in the movies, but I had retained the right to approve Jake. And they mentioned a couple of guys that I didn't think would fit, you know, in a southern courtroom with a coat and tie on, trying to fake a southern accent because you can't fake it. And I just couldn't see these guys. And I kept saying no and no and no. And the lawyers got involved, and you know, things were tense. And they read the contract. They said, yeah, Grisham has the right to veto these actors. And so I kept vetoing. And Joel Schumacher, to his credit, said, wait a minute, time out. Let's be friends. He said, I've got a guy in mind. I know this young actor who's on a set somewhere. I'm going to pull him in real quick for a quick screen test, and I'll FedEx the cassette to you. This is 95 before the internet.
Right. Yeah.
And so we got this cassette one day. We were waiting at the door, and it came in, plugged it in the old recorder, VCR, and there was Matthew on screen, talking to the jury. And both of us said, Renee said, she said, I think I'm in love.
The truth from the wife. I love
that. That's what most women say when they meet Matthew.
True.
And, I thought he was just magical. And we said, this is our guy. And the fact that he was an unknown actor in such a big movie became another story from the movie. You know, the fact that we trusted a rookie with this big budget film, and he's untested, and the way he pulled it off was just beautiful, and it became, you know, huge. And Matthew said, yeah, it launched his career. It made him, got him started.
So absolutely. He's been very enjoyable. I love on your website that he reads a segment from the book on your website. So it was kind of nice to hear that again. It was like, oh, Jake, there he is, Matthew McConaughey. And it was kind of nice to look at again, too, just saying.
Yeah. He is aging beautifully. He looks very good.
No kidding. I have to ask you, because so many of my friends have always asked me, where did you get the idea for The Firm?
Every book, almost every story has some basis in reality. That goes back to law school at Ole Miss. I was not heavily recruited out of law school. Let's put it that way. I didn't really interview with firms because I wanted to go back to my hometown and hang out my shingle and start from scratch and run for office. I had a seat in the legislature I'd picked out. I wanted to run. So that was my plan. So I didn't go through the interview. I wouldn't have worked for a big firm anyway. And there weren't many big firms in Mississippi. A close friend of mine was the top student in our class. And so he got all the big interviews. And he would go to Houston to visit a law firm. He would come back and tell us about that trip in New Orleans and Memphis and Atlanta and all these southern towns. And we were kind of vicariously living through it with him because he yeah. was – he was getting nice offers, and you know we could only dream. And he came back from an interview one weekend. I think it was like Kansas City, and he said, and we would always ask him, hey, what was it like? What was the firm like? What did they offer you? You know, and he said that was a really strange small little tax firm in Kansas City. He said, I got the impression that once you joined that firm, you never really left. And we had a good laugh about it. That stuck. And 10 years later, or 9 years later, and I thought about it over the years. I didn't think about writing the story. But as I was finishing A Time to Kill and thinking about the next book, Time to Kill was published. And it didn't sell, and it was kind of frustrating. And I told my wife, I said, I'm going to write one more book. And if it doesn't sell, it flops too, I'm going to forget this little secret hobby and just, you know, be a lawyer and sue people. And one day in the kitchen, and we still do this after all these years, I'll say, give me a minute, okay? And she'll say, Renee will say, okay, what is it? And I'll say, here's the pitch. And it's actually a very good exercise, because if you can't pitch your idea quickly, you're probably in trouble.
Right.
And I said, here's the idea. There's a little small tax firm in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis is the only place I've ever been, the only city. And I said, it's secretly owned by the mafia, and they do the dirty work for the mafia, and they hire good lawyers. And once you join the firm, you never leave. And Renee, to her credit, said, wow, that could be fun. That could be a fun book. And that's where the firm came from.
I love it. And the fact that we learned that Renee really is the power behind this, isn't she?
You know, listen, we had, last weekend, we had I gave her a 2-page summary of a book I want to write starting in January, the next legal thriller.
Oh.
And we do this all the time. And she went through it and raised some concerns. Overall, generally approved it, liked it. I'll go back and tinker with it, but I've got the idea. Last month, she flat out vetoed a book. She said, I don't want you writing this book at this time, because it was a different kind of book. So anyway, yeah, we have some pretty serious conversations about what's next.
Did she ever give you any ideas, or, you know, say, hey, I read this, check this out? Or is she just more of the, I'm going to tell you yay or nay?
We have a great story. 4 or 5 years ago, we were driving to Florida, our annual summer road trip. We load up the dog. The kids are all grown. She'll fix some great food. We'll hop in the big SUV and take off to Florida, 10 hours away. Wow. We like a certain beach down there. And so we were driving to Florida, and we listened to NPR. We listened to books on tape, listen to music. We talk, we snap, we take turns. We look forward to it every year. The dog has a ball. And so we were listening to NPR, a great NPR segment about stolen rare books and stolen rare manuscripts.
Oh.
And thievery is a big problem in this field, because libraries are not known for their, you know, security, and they're easy targets, or have been for a long time. And so we the segment went off, and we were talking, and we said, how would you fashion a mystery involving stolen books or stolen manuscripts? So we talked about this all the way to Florida, and just created this mystery, and it became Camino Island.
A summer
beach book. And so that's what happens around our house. We're always talking about ideas that could be future books. She loves Theo, the Theodore Boone series. My kids are involved in that. And we're always kicking around ideas for what could be the next book.
Why children's books? I find that really interesting. Why did you decide to write some children's books?
It goes back to my daughter. About 10 years ago, she was teaching school, her first year of teaching school. She had a bunch of fifth graders in a very nice school down in Raleigh, where she lives. And she was excited about teaching. She wanted to push literacy and reading and make kids love to read. Renee and I helped her set up her classroom. We bought all the Hardy Boys books and Nancy Drew and stocked the library. And it was a lot of fun. And she came home after about a month of teaching school. And over dinner one night, she asked me if I could write suspense for kids. And I thought, I'd never thought about writing for kids. And she said, yeah. She said, I can't find a lot of good suspense. She said, there are a lot of great kids' books. They have historical fiction. They have fantasy. They have all this stuff, you know, that kids can read. She said, but I can't find any real good suspense for kids. And that was the challenge. And that's how Theodore Boone came about.
Wow, that's great. And what a noble profession that she's doing. That's terrific. I want to get to some questions here, because I know we have a bunch and I want to try and get everybody's in for you. So let me ask you some, if that's okay.
Sure.
This one's from Fern. And she says, what's the connection between the beginning of the book where the young man kills his mother's aggressor and the remainder of the book?
Well, he is immediately arrested and soon charged with capital murder. And you know, Jake is forced to defend him. He doesn't want to. And however, once Jake has that job, that task, he's all in, and he leads the defense, and it's a very unpopular case in a small town. And you can see it's going to trial, and there's not going to be a guilty plea, not going to be a plea bargain. Neither side's going to give an inch. It's going to trial. It will be determined by a jury. And that's what the whole story's about.
You've had experience. I mean, obviously coming from a small town, being a small town lawyer, have you had cases that you did not want to take? And how do you sort of process that and deal with that, knowing that everybody deserves a defense, but you may not like this defense or that defendant?
It's tough. It's really tough. It's tough on lawyers. And I think in your cities, bigger towns, you've always got a handful of lawyers who sort of thrive on the unpopular criminal cases, who like the challenge of it, who like death penalty litigation, which is very, very strenuous. In small towns, though, where your reputation is what you've got at stake, you worry about doing damage to that by getting close to too many criminals or people charged with terrible crimes. And it was a constant balance. I never had a case. I never saw a case locally. I only practiced for 10 years, but there were two really horrible crimes that I remember. And we didn't have a public defender system because the county was too small. And I was really hoping that my phone wouldn't ring. I was hoping the judge wouldn't call me, because you really can't say no to your judge. And we had two, we all respected the judge, respected the system. And, we respected the prosecutors and the police. It was a very good system. And I never had a client who I thought was wrongfully convicted, because, again, it was run fair. But you really, when your judge asks you to do something, you just about have to do it. And I knew that if I got the call, I would have no choice but to step in. And then, once you're there, you ethically, you have to provide a strong defense. People would ask me all the time, how can you defend somebody you know to be guilty? And I always say, well, let's just agree that we're all entitled to a fair trial. And a fair trial means a good lawyer. And if your brother was charged with a terrible crime, would you want some lawyer who was going to do his best to represent him, or some guy who said, no, I don't want this case because you're guilty? You want a real lawyer in the courtroom. And that's the balance that lawyers are always struggling to achieve.
Mm. Okay, let's go back to the children's novels books. Rand Hyman wants to know, when you write for children, do you start with a grown-up idea and then try to retell it or dial it down for children, or do you have an entirely different starting point?
Tough question. I generally start at the kids' level. Because it's difficult to write the kids' books in that the plots are simpler, the language is simpler, all that kind of stuff. They're shorter books. The difficult part is writing like a 13-year-old from that point of view. And I struggle often to find that, the right voice, the right balance there. But I believe I'm trying to think of all seven of them. I approach them from the way a kid, the way Theodore Boone would look at the matter. In the last book, The Accomplice, one of his close friends gets arrested and charged with a serious crime. And the kid's in jail and can't get out. And so Theo gets really worked up because the kid can't get out of jail. He's presumed innocent, of course. And Theo knows he's really innocent and wants to get him out. So Theo goes all in to help his friend. But the issue is, why can't anybody get out of jail without putting up a bunch of money when you're presumed to be innocent? So it tackles the issue of the cash bail system. But I started that from Theo's point of view.
Interesting. And I imagine that is difficult. You don't want to scare kids, but you want them to learn something about the system.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is best-selling author John Grisham, whose new novel is A Time for Mercy. He's joined in conversation by journalist Holly Furford. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
David Shapiro wants to know, when and why did you decide to pivot from practicing law to writing books?
Well, it was an easy decision. After 10 years in the law office and really fighting to get, you know, the law practice established and to make some decent money. It wasn't all about money, but I was having trouble surviving some years. And suddenly it happened in 24 hours. I mean, it was an overnight phone call that we sold the film rights to the firm in January of 1990 before we sold the book rights. And it was a weird, strange, unusual. It was the luckiest break of my career. I had nothing to do with it. It was all done by somebody else. And suddenly I had this big check that was coming my way from Paramount Pictures for the film rights of the firm. And at that point I could, you know, get up and walk out of the office, which I did a year later and never looked back.
And obviously you enjoy it or else you wouldn't leave something that you did that you for something you didn't love.
Right.
So Rhonda Stewart wants to know, is there anything in particular that moved the humanitarian spirit in you to work with the Equal Justice Project and write three great novels about equal justice?
What motivated me? I think it's people like Brian Stevenson with the Equal Justice Initiative. It's people like Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, who started the Innocence Project. It's activists like that who are in the trenches, you know, defending people on death row or trying to get people out of prison. Those people to me are, you know, very inspirational. Jim McCloskey, who founded Centurion Ministries and to date has walked out 64 innocent people over a 45-year career. Those people are extremely inspirational to me.
Robert Hirsch wants to know, is there a chance that Time for Mercy will be made into a movie?
Always the chance. I would love to see all of my books adapted to good movies or good TV shows because we all enjoy them. I'm not sure what's going to happen right now with feature films because nobody can film right now and nobody can go to the theaters. Theaters are all closing. So that future is really shaky right now. The money has been in television for 15 years, the money and the talent, and for obvious reasons. We love our shows, and we love to binge on them. We love to, you know, talk about new ones, and we're always looking at some new TV show. But again, that's where the money has gone. That's where the talent has gone. I have probably right now three or four deals with TV deals working. Nothing will be filmed anytime soon. There are two or three movie deals, feature film deals, but nothing is happening right now. Mercy is going to be pretty simple. I think if Matthew says that he wants to do a Time for Mercy, at that point it becomes a very viable project and will probably get done. And I'm not sure anybody's talked to him yet. I mean, the book just came out, so those discussions will be carried out by somebody, not me, but by, you know, agents, representatives. And at some point, it'll be discussed with Matthew. We'll see.
We can cross our fingers. Okay, so Kenny Bell wants to know, what are your feelings on the sentences for John Allen, Muhammad, and Lee Boyd Malvo? It's very specific. Those were the snipers in D.C. years ago.
Yeah, we lived through that. We were living here in Charlottesville 20 years ago when it happened, and we had our son was playing high school football, and we had a game in the D.C. area, a school up there. And I think they almost canceled the game, or anyway, we were remotely affected by it. Just a terrible case of two men. Muhammad has already been executed. I think he was executed by the state of Virginia several years ago. Malvo was the kid. I forget how old he was, 14, 15, 16.
Right.
Who was given he was given life. I can't remember all of the, he may be given death, but he has now been resentenced. Malvo is never going to get out. There's just too much political pressure. to keep him in because, you know, because it was such a horrendous crime or crimes. He killed so many people. So there's still an ongoing claim somewhere with that case. And I wish I could tell you what it is, but it's not quite finished yet.
Jeff Sopshin wants to know about Calico Jack. Interested in the background of Calico Jack and the progress on the movie.
Well, it's the book came out 7 or 8 years ago, and we had a movie deal that fell through, and the option expired. I got the rights back. That happened 2 or 3 times. What I did not know was way back then, Bob Dylan read the book and called to see if the film rights were available, and they were not. Somebody else had them tied up trying to make the movie. A couple of months ago, in the summertime, on a hot Saturday afternoon, my phone rang. It was my agent calling from New York, and he said, "You're never going to believe who wants to make the movie Calico Joe, buy the film rights." And I said, to surprise me, he said, "Bob Dylan." And I said, "I thought he was a singer."
Okay, yeah.
I said, "Sure, that sounds like fun." And so Bob Dylan gets things done. And so he hired George Clooney to write and direct and maybe star in the movie. And so it's supposed to be off and running. We'll see. But we've got some names attached to it. Yeah.
I love it. This is from Deborah Jacobs. Do you research one book at a time? Or are you researching more than one book right now?
I'm always clipping articles and filing stuff away in my computer just for further use. Something that interests me, I'll file it away somewhere and get back to it later. So I'm always collecting things, collecting articles, collecting even books that may help me out in the future. So that goes on. Once I start writing, though, once I pick the next project, the next book, I don't work on anything else. I can't, I can't stand to be distracted. And I research one thing, write one thing, and go hard at it for 6 months.
What's your writing process? You know, some people say I get up really early and I do 4 hours, or some people say I'm a night writer. What's your process like?
It's early. It's roughly 7:30 for about 4 hours. My little writing office is dark and windows are covered and there's no phone, fax, internet, music, nothing. Nobody's in there but me. You don't collaborate when you write. And I can get a lot of work done, and I can write enough in one day in 4 hours. It's usually 1,000 words, sometimes 2,000.
Wow.
Sometimes 500. But, you know, 1,000 is always the goal. You do that 5 days a week and the pages are going to pile up pretty fast.
Gotcha. Okay. Somebody wants to know, Lindsay Berger wants to know, Joe, do you have a favorite book and have you written, and why is it your favorite? Is that like asking you to pick a child?
No, not really, because there's 45 kids now. Some of the books, you know, I can look back on now with some measure of, hindsight and wisdom and say, you know, that was a better one. That was not a better one. A Time to Kill is always going to be my favorite because it was the first, and I didn't know if it was going to get finished or even published or whatever. And to see it now be the biggest seller of all of them is gratifying. And again, it was very autobiographical.
Here's a question. What would be the one book that you wrote that you would tell everybody to read? I guess it's sort of the same one or same kind of question, but is there one you're like, everyone needs to know about this one?
Other than Time to Kill, I would say The Innocent Man, which is a nonfiction book, because it's a very hard look at wrongful convictions and what makes them happen and how they could easily be avoided if we would just do it.
Okay. Leslie Cher says she greatly enjoyed Camino Island and Camino Winds. Is there a possibility of another sequel to that series as well?
Yes. Yes. Once I finished Camino Winds, I really liked the setting, the characters, the bookstore, the issues. And I talked to Doubleday and they offered me a 2-book deal for 2 more, set books 2 and 3 of the Camino Island series. Camino Winds was the first of those two. And then in a couple of years, I'll write the third one. And depending on how that goes, there could be another one after that. I don't really have, I've got sort of a story now for number three. I don't think I've got one for number four. But yeah, probably, and this is, they're 3 years apart. So in 2023, I'll publish the next Camino book.
Ooh, can't wait. Melissa Gordon Ryan says, speak about how your books translate to movies. Do you write the scripts or the screenplays? How involved are you in the script or the screenplay?
It's best not to get involved. Let the professionals make the movies. I've tried screenwriting. It's a different set of muscles, and I'm not, you know, I didn't really like it. And the thing about making, to the comparing the two, when I write a book, I'm in charge of every word. They can't change a word unless I agree to it. They can't change anything. They can suggest I change something, and I'll listen to them. But nobody is going to mess with your book. You have final authority over everything. In a movie, I've seen this happen on the set. They'll bring the screenwriter out because Tom Cruise wants to change his dialogue. Okay. Well, Tom Cruise gets whatever he wants. He changes dialogue.
Of course he does. Right?
So they'll film that. It's four or five different takes on that. And then 6 months later, when the movie's all filmed, they're in editing and the editor gets the final cut about which take they use. So which dialogue is going to be used. So the writer has no clue, has no control over anything in a movie. And that's just kind of hard for a novelist to get used to. You know, if you're a full-time screenwriter, you're accustomed to collaborating and seeing your stuff cut and left behind. A novelist just can't do that.
That's why it's important for you to read the book before you see the movie. See?
Oh, always. The book's always better.
Absolutely. Sissy Luciani wants to know, with the government beginning to prioritize which populations will first get the COVID vaccine and your interest in and work with the homeless and prison populations, what are your thoughts on how we take care of these two groups?
Gosh, what a nightmare. I mean, who is going to make that decision about who is the most essential and who is the least essential? And that's what it's going to come down to. And I don't know how we make that. I don't know who's going to be in charge of that. I wouldn't want
right.
the job.
No.
But, you know, it's probably going to be the people with the money and the insurance are going to get it first. And, the poor folks are going to get screwed again. And the prisoners and children and homeless people. And, you know, we don't prioritize those people. We don't help them.
Do you feel like, you know, because of who you are and your past work with, you know, those folks with the Innocence Project, that it's something that you may want to sort of, you know, put your name on and say, look, let's make this an issue. Let's make this a priority too. Let's not let these people get lost.
Honestly, I have not thought about that.
Right.
The question is, I think for all of us, is who's going to volunteer to be the guinea pig and take it in the first stage initially, you know?
I might. I'm getting tired of looking at these four walls.
Oh, aren't we all? Aren't we all?
Linda Vogel once says, there seems to be two concurrent stories, capital murder and the train accident. This is in A Time for Mercy. The latter ends, well, I don't want to say too much, but without conclusion. So was that intentional? And obviously, because maybe you're thinking about a sequel.
Yeah, the thing about the train, that was a real case. It was based on a case I had when I was a young lawyer. I got lucky and got this big case and almost screwed it up. When you last see Jake in A Time to Kill, he's broke and he got paid nothing for. They burned his house down. They burned his clothes. He has nothing when it's over, okay? In Sycamore Row, he makes a nice fee. He's trying to get on his feet. He and Carla buy a bigger house. You know, they're trying to get ahead. But when you meet him in A Time for Mercy, he's still, you know, he's still pretty broke, in debt and borrowing, you know, for this big lawsuit he's got going on. And I wanted to give the reader some hope that Jake is not going to be bankrupt when you see him again. Okay, I think the railroad case is going to work out okay, and he's going to have a little money in his pocket. I hope so, because he sure deserves it.
Got it. Ronald Rothschild asks, have you ever written a book where the prosecutor is the central character? He has written over 25. I've read over 25 of your suspense novels and do not recall that you've created a heroic prosecutor.
Yeah. True. You're very observant. Thank you for that. I have thought about it. I have collected stories over the years about prosecutors, state and federal. They have been filed away. That's on my list of potential stories to write about.
Perfect. Rita Solomon wants to know, would you consider bringing Jake to the small screen in a streaming format similar to Harry Bosch?
Yes. At this point, I think everything is on the table. With feature films, you know, fading quickly, the prospect of a feature film, everything else is on the table. You know, a 4, 5, 6 installment, episode installment, streaming, it's all, you know, it's all there and it'll be discussed.
David wants to know, how long does it take to write a book?
I start every year on January the 1st, make myself start the book. And my deadline is July the 1st. And I usually am a couple of days early. I like to be early to turn it in. So 6 months. I've never done one in less than 5 months. One book, The Chamber, years ago, I could just never get it finished in time. But I've been on this January to July schedule for many years now. And it's the ebb and flow around our house. We're just used to it. We kind of plan our year based on that book.
That's inspiring. So then in January, when I say I'm going to lose weight and go to the gym, you're an inspiration. If you can get till July, so can I. if you don't mind, I have some quick rapid fire questions. I really love to do this because I think it's fun and we get to know some things about you before we leave that we might not. And I steal this completely from James Lipton, who stole it from someone else. So I'm okay with that. So I'm going to ask you some rapid fire questions. First one is morning or evening? Are you a morning person, evening person? What do you prefer?
Morning.
Favorite holiday?
Thanksgiving.
Favorite book?
Favorite book, The Grapes of Wrath.
Best advice you have ever been given?
When The Firm came out, a young executive with the old Walden bookstore over lunch told me something I've never forgotten. He said, the big guys come out every year. And I had never thought about that. He said, the big writers, Stephen King, Robert Ludlum, you know, back then it was the top 10 writers, they come out every year. He said, if you want to establish your career, come out every year.
If you did not start your life as a lawyer, what would you be now?
Probably in some type of business. Our family background was in construction machinery, and my father had a business selling construction machinery, and I would probably have gone into that.
Favorite adult beverage?
Wine.
I knew we could be friends. Well, thank you. See, you've answered all our questions. Inquiring minds wanted to know. But thank you so much, John. A Time for Mercy is so great. And we're so happy to have Jake back. And we look forward to the next one. We really appreciate you being here. And look forward to doing this maybe this time next year for the next book.
Thank you, Holly. Great job. I'll see you next time.
Thank you. And I want to thank everybody who was here and let everybody know. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay sane. Bye.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was best-selling author John Grisham, whose new novel is A Time for Mercy. He was joined in conversation by journalist Holly Furfer. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.